You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is Brian McClanahan, your host, and this is episode 41, covering the week of September 5th through 9th, 2016. Glad to have you back on the program. We had a lot of good stuff on the website this week. But before we get to that, I want to remind you that the Abbeville Institute exists because of your generous contribution. So if you like this podcast, if you like the website and the material we have on that, if you like our conferences and what we do there, please consider making a tax-deductible donation to the Abbeville Institute. It is tax-deductible to the full extent of the law. Help us out. Help us explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition. We've got a lot of good ideas for the future of the Institute. Moving forward into 2017, I think you'll like some of the things we're doing, but we do need your help. So in the show notes of this podcast, I will put the link out there to become a member of the Institute for about the price of a Waffle House All-Star Special one time a month. You can go on and become a member of the Institute and help us out. We'd be greatly appreciated, and you could help keep this thing going, keep the lights on at the website, and help us defend and explore the Southern tradition. Okay, so let's talk about the material we had on the website for the week. And we started with a piece by the late Tom Landis. And Tom Landis had been around the Southern movement for a long time. He died not many years ago, but this particular piece was written in 1984, and it's entitled Freedom and More Freedom. Now, there was a little bit of misconception on our social media pages, our Facebook page. Also, like us on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. Little bit of misconception about what this article was about on our Facebook page, and people believed it was an attack on public education. Now, certainly, there are many problems with public education, but the point of this piece was not to attack public education, but to attack the culture that's producing some of the problems in public education. In fact, Landis says it best. There's really no point, in quote, there's really no point in talking about improving curricula or raising SAT scores until we address ourselves to the basic problem of discipline in a world gone mad. And so one of the posters on our Facebook page talked about, well, I mean, you know, this is all, you know, all this is produced by yourselves. I mean, if you want to clean up the schools, go out and get involved in the schools. Well, what Landis is saying here is that really doesn't make a difference because the parents, the culture that produces the children in the schools is decadent and corrupt. And the teachers who are trying to get involved in this. And what happened here, there was a colleague that he knew from a Southern college, went to a New York City school in 1984 and was appalled by the things that he saw, or things that she saw, I should say, the things that were going on in this high school, and how teachers were being threatened daily with violence, and the actions of the students were just outrageous. And so the problem is not that the kids, I mean, the kids are a problem, but they're a reflection of society as a whole. And one of the things that the kids don't understand, or at least American society doesn't understand, is that there are two different types of freedom, and that's what Landis gets into. There's initial freedom and terminal freedom. He says they're both valuable. He says that initial freedom is the absence of external strictures which permits you to make choices and to take independent action. It's the kind of freedom a boy longs for when he stares out the window at a fish pond on a spring day. Terminal freedom, he says, is a subtler in concept and perhaps more important. It is the freedom to actualize your potential as a human being, the ability to accomplish what you want or ought to do. He says, I am not terminally free to jog around the block more than once, no matter how much I'd like to. Frank Shorter, on the other hand, is free to run the Boston Marathon or do so without dropping dead. So these are your limits. But he says Frank Shorter can run the Boston Marathon only because he has surrendered thousands and thousands of free hours to the rigors of a training regimen. Likewise, the boy wants to go fishing must, alas, attend school instead, that is, if he's ever going to read. And since he's too young to know what's best for him, society takes away his initial freedom in his own behalf. So we have to understand there's these two different types of freedom, and we often confuse them. We don't really nurture terminal freedom, and we believe too much in initial freedom. And this is a cultural problem, not a school problem. It's a cultural problem. He says, understood in this context, we can see exactly what is happening to our schools today. In the name of one kind of freedom, We are destroying forever our children's opportunity to enjoy that other, higher kind, the sort of freedom which is referred to in the phrase liberal education. When we allow them the freedom to skip school, to shout and make obscene gestures in class, to talk back to their teachers, and even to assault them physically, we are condemning them to the final tyranny of their own narrow and ignorant souls. So this is a cultural problem. It's not a school problem. It's a cultural problem. And no matter what the schools can do, the culture is supporting this type of activity. And I think you see it even worse today in many situations across the United States. This is 1984. I mean, this is 32 years ago. And it's only gotten worse since then. Of course, this is a blanket statement. There are schools that do just fine with these things. But overall, what you're seeing in America is that we have this belief in initial freedom trumping everything else. There's no discipline, and no one's required to really express their potential because they don't have the discipline to do it. And so that's what Dr. Landis is saying here, that we need to focus on that. As a culture, we need to start bringing back the idea of discipline, that we've allowed too much of the other. So it was an interesting little piece. And in that way, I mean, the piece that followed up the next day was kind of on the same theme. This was written by Dr. Mark Malvasi back in the 1990s. And it was entitled Choosing Southernness, Southern with an Italian Accent. This is a very interesting piece because Malvasi was not born in the United... Well, I'm sorry, his family was not around during the time of the Civil War. He was told that his grandfather didn't come over from the old country till 1907. He wasn't born until 1898, and the Civil War was over by then. So Malvasi was just depressed to learn that he didn't have, growing up in the South, and he didn't have any direct family influence in that war. And so he started looking into this and saying, well, you can actually choose to be Southern. But he also found that there was a lot of similarities between Italian culture in the old world and Southern culture in the antebellum period. And he goes into explaining this. Now, Dr. Malvasi is one of the leading experts in the United States on the Southern agrarians. And so he really liked what they had to say about agrarian society. And he liked Robert Penn Warren and all the great names from that period, from that 1930 Manifesto of I'll Take My Stand, Frank Owsley. What he decided was that, there's more to being Southern than just a location. So I said he was born in the South. He wasn't. He lived in Ohio, excuse me. And he said that he lived there all but four of his 36 years in the North. He was educated in northern schools, colleges, and universities. And when he said he read William Faulkner and Robert Penn Warren and Flannery O'Connor, he started thinking about the South, but it wasn't until he became a student of Eugene Genovese that he really started seeing that his heart was in Dixie. And he found a lot of similarities between his own culture, his own background, and these people in the South. And he told a story of, some of the things that went on in his little neighborhood, at least that he was told about growing up. And basically, the concept is that these people police themselves. It was a tight-knit community, and they had a general attitude of leave us alone. And he brings up that many Southerners, this was a general part of Southern culture, sweep around your own doorstep in your own community and take care of your own business and don't worry about what everybody else does. And he found that intoxicating. He found that those two things lining up together and that you can choose to be Southern. It doesn't have to be where you're born. It can be what's in your heart. He says, the allegiance to family and community, the dual foundations of order in our little portion of the earth, did not only demand a theoretical defense of abstract principle. There were occasions when such allegiances demanded more. And so he talks about these stories about his father and some of the things that went on there. And in particular, some family violence that his family had to deal with. And he says, you know, his father never read John C. Calhoun or Southern political thinkers. But he said instinctively he shares their misgivings about the growing power of a bloated, reckless, and for all that, ineffective federal bureaucracy that probes deeper into all aspects of our lives. So he's seeing parallels between the Southern tradition and these tight-knit, very, you know, provincial communities. And how that part of the Southern tradition is so important to hang on to. Community. And that's why he was attracted, I think, in so many ways to the agrarians. And he says, look, antebellum Southerners like Pettigrew, James Johnson Pettigrew of South Carolina, loved Italy. And they saw a lot of similarities between Italy and the South. So when you look at what it means to be Southern, and we talk about the Southern tradition quite a bit on this podcast, when we've said before the phrase, the South is America, well, this is true. The South is America. And part of that Americanism, so to speak, is this idea of community and local over the national. Now, we've forgotten that in American society, but that really was the core in so many ways of what the South was looking for throughout most of its history. And we can talk about the issues and why they wanted that, but at its core, that's something we can take away from it and really apply to modern life. Because if we can do that on a regular basis, then modern life becomes more meaningful and more humane. He talks about Alan Tate, and he says that, you know, today many reject original sin and instead embrace the vision that human nature is innately good, or at least a blank slate upon which social scientists and behavioral therapists can inscribe an appropriate personality. They assume that violence and crime originate not from human depravity, but from the social deprivation, poverty, a bad neighborhood, a broken home. But as Southern thinkers have long maintained, society is not the criminal. Instead, it is the force that keeps the criminal at bay. So this is a very Hobbesian look at the world and what Malvesi is saying here. And he brings up Alan Tate had said about this 40 years ago. He says that man will never be completely and permanently enslaved. He will rebel, as he is rebelling now, in a shocking variety of existential disorders all over the world. If his human nature as such cannot participate in the action of society, he will not capitulate to it if that action is inhumane. He will not turn it upon himself. Man may destroy himself, but he will not at last tolerate anything less than his full human condition. Tate also discerned the fragility of civilization and understood how feeble a barrier it was against the demonic aspects of human nature. But this is what's important. You know, the South is the heart of American civilization. And if we lose that, we are losing civilization. America, people point to it all the time. So what can the South offer for that? So Richard Weaver said years ago, you know, we may not want to live in the antebellum South, but the antebellum South can teach us something about how we should live. That's a very important lesson, I think, moving forward as we look at these things. And so we have these cultural anchors, so to speak. The South provides that, these cultural anchors, whether it's Christianity, provincialism, community. We have these things, terminal freedom, the idea that we should reach our full potential as best we can. And of course, these things aren't unique to the South, but the South held on to them for a lot longer than other parts of America did. So we have these anchors. And now, as Landis said, we're in a world gone mad. We're moving away from that. And we've transitioned into something else. Malvesi brings up a 1958 quote from Donald Davidson, where he says, For brevity, I might call it the cause of civilized society, that is, the South, as we have known it in the Western world, against the new barbarism of science and technology controlled and directed by the modern power state. In this sense, the cause of the South was and is the cause of Western civilization itself. So if we can hang on to that, if we can bottle that and harness it and use that power to move forward, I mean, this is what we're saying about trying to explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition. All traditions have things that are negative, things you may not want. But the good aspects of it we're forgetting, because as we demonize the South, those things just become suppressed. And we accept, as Davidson said, this modernity, this consumerism that's engulfing America, something different. So if we can hang on to this other stuff and build from that, we could create something entirely new that's based on something very good and old. It's not about a utopian vision. It's about hanging on to tradition in a world gone mad, as Landis said. And as the next piece on Wednesday, Call Me Simple with Strange Word for Strange Days, Clyde Wilson is pointing out. And he looks at the twisting of language nowadays, particularly the strange words. And he says, charity, old version, open-handedness toward our neighbor in need. The new version, though, is getting the government to spend other people's money on politically favored groups at home and abroad. All men are created equal. The old version, we are all made in the image of God and deserve respect. New version, the government should force people to pretend that we're all alike and interchangeable. Serial killers, old version, none of the notorious serial killers of the 20th century were Southern white men. New version, when shown in the movies, all serial killers must be Southern white men. National defense, old version, guarding the country against attack. New version, killing foreigners for democracy. Justice, old version, what is fair and right. New version, what produces the most lucrative outcome for politically favored minorities. And on and on. So what we've done is taken something that was stable and known and transformed it into something else. And so you have, as Landis said, we're in a world gone mad. That's because the old version of things no longer count. We've got a new version. But what we're trying to do at the Institute, and things like Malvasi's piece and others, is trying to remind people there's another way. And if we had that base, then the political side could work. We could look at smaller political communities. We could look at smaller, more humane governments. But you have to have, I mean, anyone in the founding generation recognized this. You have to have a moral, sound base to your community to make those things work, or it won't. Or it won't at all. And so when you look at 1861, and as the South decided to secede, and they wrote a constitution. And the piece on Thursday by Robert Martin Schaeffer was about Marshall DeRosa's book, The Confederate Constitution of 1861. And if you've never read that book, I'd highly recommend it, because what DeRosa does very well is go through and compare the U.S. Constitution to the Confederate Constitution. And so he looks at these and he says, you know what, and Shearer does a great job with this, pointing out that the Confederate Constitution actually allowed for a greater sense of republicanism. But why could it do that? Why could you have this Confederate Constitution that allowed for that type of thing to exist? And that's because of their society. The anchor of their society would allow for that. They were provincial. They were local. They understood that the states could handle things in small local communities better than a central authority. They had independence. They had terminal freedom. So it's harder to have a decentralized, much more active citizenry than it is to have a centralized, mindless group of sheeple who will just do whatever the central government tells them to do. Freedom is difficult. The South knew freedom was difficult. Most people in history don't understand that freedom is difficult. Terminal freedom requires discipline. It is difficult. Initial freedom does not. Initial freedom is do whatever you want. That's not difficult. But then, how are you going to maintain society acting that way, was Landis's main point. And if you just have a society of people who believe in initial freedom, no one will ever achieve their full potential. So we have this wrestling with culture that's being changed by consumerism, which in many ways allows for a tremendous amount of initial freedom. I want this, I'll go get it. I want that, I'll go get it. Immediate gratification. There's no discipline, no self-sacrifice, no patience. Agriculture forces you to have those kind of opinions because you have to have patience, you have to have self-sacrifice, you have to have discipline to live in that kind of environment. Consumeristic environment doesn't allow you to do that. So when you look at the Confederate Constitution and the federal system it established, it was based on that type of understanding. And Scherer says this, the South clearly understood itself to be different from the industrial North. Hamilton blatantly states that the new Union would diminish the fundamental differences between the states. Although Hamilton does not admit it, commerce detaches the natural attachment citizens have for their traditions, communities, and families, and redirects their attention to the business of making money. This is exactly what Malvasia was getting at, what Landis is getting at, what Clyde was getting at, and why the Confederate Constitution could work. Because you had this ingrained culture, this stable anchor that kept the people tied to something real. Now, Scherer says this is a great conclusion. Reflecting upon the constitutions of 1787, the U.S. Constitution, and 1861 can assist us in understanding the true meaning of constitutionalism and, more importantly, the limits of government. DeRosa rightly notes that the contributions of the Confederate framers made to past debates and what they have to offer regarding contemporary ones has been neglected. He stresses that state governments rule themselves more efficiently and justly than a national government, precisely because the citizens of each state are capable of controlling their legislatures. He concludes by arguing that limited government was the Confederate ideal, and state sovereignty was more conducive to that Southern preference than was the alternative national sovereignty. True and proper republicanism, then, is seen more clearly in the CSA Constitution than in its noble predecessor. Again, so how could they do that? Because they had a foundation, an anchor. And that's how they could do that. That's something we need to understand as we're looking at, we look at everything in political solutions. So not everything can have a political solution. Why is it that decentralization should even be pursued? If we all had one national culture and one belief system and move that forward, then a large centralized government might work. But the problem is, you can't really ever have that over so large a territory and so diverse of a population. Even in 1861, you had different peoples. You had different peoples in 1607 and 1620 and 1624 and 1626, as you had the establishment of New England and Southern colonies. And then, of course, the middle colonies, entirely different as well. You had different cultures and peoples here, even if they were English in background. They're still different cultures. And that agrarianism, as Scherer correctly points out, is the real conflict. You have Wall Street versus Main Street. When you look at the populist revolt of the 1890s, really all that was Western farmers figuring out they got shafted when they joined up with Republican New England business interests during the war, and they had swung back around. The system wasn't working for them. Centralization wasn't working for them. It was actually destroying them. But yet, because the mechanism was there, they could go out and start pursuing something through the central authority. That 20th century period is fascinating if you look at it from a different perspective than what you've been taught. So you look at why the South pursued political independence. It was because their culture could warrant that. I'm not so certain today the culture could warrant it. We talk about, again, political solutions, but what are we trying to stop? When you say we're for decentralization, what you're saying is the culture of our area is different from the center, and we want to preserve it. It's worth preserving, but you got to have something worth preserving, and it can't just be something political. It has to be something real. It can't just be taxes. You have had tax revolts in American history that have produced secession movements, Western Pennsylvania in the 1790s. But they were also protecting a way of life that was under assault by Alexander Hamilton's excise tax and his banking system and everything else. They were protecting that. So you have to have something more than just saying, I don't want to pay that in taxes. It's got to be something real, and it's got to be a social issue, a cultural issue. And what people don't realize is that the best way to hang on to that is through decentralization. So on Friday, it's a piece by yours truly, Decentralization for Humanity's Sake. I bring up Roman history and how the Roman Empire fell apart because the Germanic peoples weren't meshing with Roman culture. Really, the Roman nation didn't exist outside of Rome. It fell apart because it became diverse. And the Germans and the Celts didn't want to be necessarily Roman like the Romans were. They had their own traditions that helped break it apart. And if you look at the United States, it's that exact same way. If you look at any demographic map of the United States, you see regional cultures. Some of that's based on ethnic background or race. Sometimes it's religion. Sometimes it's just identification. But you clearly see it. And even in 1787, people were saying, look, we can't govern the United States with one central authority. It's impossible. Because you're going to harm culture when you try to do that. We have too many different peoples, different laws, different customs, different opinions. So you can't govern 320 million people with 545. It's impossible. So when we look at what we could do to help solve this issue in America, it is decentralization. Why is it Americans are so angry? Because they're angry because the central authority is engulfing their culture. It's taking it over. They're seeing what they enjoy and what they want destroyed by a central authority that tells them these are the right things to do and you got to do it no matter what. We're going to tell you how to live and you're going to follow that or we'll see you in court. Well, people are buckling under that. They don't want it. And it doesn't matter which group is in power because 50% of the population is not represented by that other group. So the real solution is not to force your will on 50% of the population, but to say, hey, look, you want to live your way? You go live your way in California or Massachusetts or Alabama. You go live your way there, and you would produce more happiness. Now, one of the main arguments against all this, of course, is suppression of minority interests. But as I bring up in this article, if you look at it, minority interests are suppressed on a much greater scale by the general government than they are at the state level. And I use data from Mississippi and Alabama to back that up. If you look at, for example, the number of black representatives in the Congress, it's minuscule. Two members of the U.S. Senate, about 9% of the House of Representatives, and the overall African-American population is 13%. If you look at Hispanic populations, it's even worse. They have no representation in Washington, D.C. They say they do, but as we've seen with all these email leaks and everything else, they really don't. It's all about votes and money and power. So if they want real representation, they should look at the state level. Because if you look at Mississippi and Alabama, where African-Americans make up a large percentage of the population in those states, they have about the same amount of representation in their state legislatures as they do in terms of the population of their state. So where do they actually have more power? Is it in Mississippi and Alabama, or is it in the U.S. Congress? This cannot be said enough. And again, in those states, you can see there might be a greater protection for minority interests for those people, or maybe those communities. And I even bring up if the counties could even get some type of negative on state law, it would be even better. What we need to do is start thinking smaller. Start looking at decentralization. Start looking at bringing it down to the local level and let people run their own lives because that will preserve culture. And we have to have something that's worth hanging on to. So we need to think about that. Be an active participant in Western civilization. Western civilization is not reactionary. It is thoughtful. You have to thoughtfully participate in it. Have terminal freedom. Do your best and find your niche in society and then work within that. And that's something more than anything else I think the Southern tradition can provide. Because here in the South, we do have a culture that's worth preserving. There are things about the South, Southern manners, Southern language, Southern cooking, Southern music. There are things worth preserving against the onslaught of the center. Even Southern political values. So those things are what we should always be trying to hang on to talk about, to trumpet. Say, this is worth it. And you're not going to change that. Christianity, white and black Southerners, are ardent Christians. More than anywhere else in the United States, they have that in common. What would a society look like that adopted those ideas? We've run pieces in the last little bit on, you know, a Southern nation, what that would look like. So this week we had a little bit of a mix. What culture should we hang on to, and then how should we do it? You put the two things together, but you got to have the culture in order for the political solution to work, because people aren't going to go out and rally around, we want lower taxes. They might vote for that, the central authority, but they're not going to rally around it to do anything more meaningful. But if there's something cultural that's being destroyed, they'll do it. They'll do it, and they'll do it every time. So that's the things we have to talk about, and that's the things that, of course, here at the Abbeville Institute we're trying to do. We're trying to explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition and maintain that for future generations, to have a depository of it, or repository, I should say, somewhere that this stuff is online, that people can find it and read it and say, yes, I've been looking for this. It's not a negative, it's a positive. And it's not exclusive, it's inclusive. You don't have to be born in the South, you just have to believe in the Southern tradition. It has nothing to do with background, just as Western civilization really has nothing to do with that. There's always been a push to try to get people to enjoy the fruits of Western civilization, no matter what their background is. Now, being born in the South certainly helps, and having that culture from the beginning helps, but it's not always essential. So I hope you enjoyed this podcast. And until next time, good day.